Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We got a loaded episode today talking about the NBA Cup and things we're going to be watching for in the non-cup nights on Thursday and Friday. That's with Tom Haverstraw. And then later, James Barlow joins for another edition of Draft Class. We're going to be breaking down AJ DeBonta leading a big-time comeback for BYU and talking about some other prospects as well. Quick heads up, Yahoo is launching an NBA-exclusive YouTube channel at Yahoo NBA on YouTube. That's where we're going to be able to find my podcast, The Dunker Spot, Big Number, and a bunch of other stuff we are planning to launch. I'm going to be doing some breakdown videos, so be sure to check that out on YouTube. Coming up, we got Tom Haverstraw. All right, Tom, let's talk about the NBA Cup and some other stuff going on around the NBA. We got our teams, Tom. Thunder destroyed the Suns on Wednesday night, 138-89. They're going to face off against the Spurs on Saturday. And of course, Knicks and Magic are going to face off as well. Let's start off with OKC versus Phoenix. They're going to be facing the Spurs on Saturday. Like I said, dude, up by 58 points in this game, Tom. I mean, like, it's just like Phoenix has been competitive. They've been a fun, good team this year. But OKC, again, just showing how much they're on a different level than everybody else this year.
Yeah, you see the stats there for Shea. 28 points, 2 rebounds, 8 assists in 27 minutes, Kev. He had a plus 43 plus minus. And sometimes that kind of like, you need to go a different layer, another layer, peel back the onion a little bit to understand what that means. So yeah, plus minus is essentially when that player was on the floor, what was the scoreboard deficit? So when he was on the floor in 27 minutes, the scoreboard was plus 43 in the OKC's favor. I actually dug this in. I looked into this just now. When he was on the floor, the score was 92-49.
All you can do is chuckle. That's really all you can do.
It's like a little over a half of basketball. 27 minutes, they scored 92 points with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander on the floor. It was Harlem Globetrotters against the Washington Generals. It was everything that you would imagine a full squad Oklahoma City Thunder team doing to an undermanned Phoenix Suns team, except for this fact. Oklahoma City is undermanned too. They didn't have Isaiah Hartenstein. They haven't had a bunch of guys on their team in this one. And if you actually look at the numbers, they haven't had their starting lineup in any game this season, Kev. Like the lineup that won the championship last year with Isaiah Hartenstein, Lou Dort, J-Dub, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and Chet, that five-man lineup hasn't taken the floor yet this season, because when J-Dub came back, Isaiah Hartenstein got hurt. And so what we're seeing now is a team that is 24-1 and they haven't even had their full squad yet, Kev. So this is all-time great. And also they might be going to another level here.
They could be going to another level. As you said, Phoenix was without Devin Booker in that game. He had a groin injury. So unfortunate for them to be without their best player. But with OKC, to your point, Tom, they haven't had their full squad at all yet this season, and yet they're still steamrolling absolutely anybody. And I think, you know, we've talked about, could they exceed the Warriors' 73 win record this year? Currently, I mean, 24-1, tied with that 2015-16 Warriors for the best 25 game start in NBA history. I wonder also if this team could also have the longest win streak in NBA history, which is 33 games set by the 1971-72 Lakers. There have only been 6 teams in NBA history to have a win streak of 20 games or more. The 12-13 Heat did it. The 15-16 Warriors started that year with 24 wins. 07-08 Rockets had 22. And then 2 teams had 20, the 11-12 Spurs and the 71-71 Bucks. That's single season win streak record. That's a long way to go for OKC. They're currently, quote unquote, only on 16 wins in a row. So they'd have to double that up in order to even be one short of the record 33 by the Lakers set in 1971-72. But the way this team is playing, Tom, you cannot rule this out being like a 78-79 win team this season. And that would mean having some of these long extended win streaks. So I do think there's a chance of that. I really do.
Oh, you want to know what's spicy about this, Kev? Is that 33 game streak, the Thunder would break it on January 15th against Houston on Amazon Prime. January 15th, circle it on your calendar, except for this fact. this championship game, if they win it, it won't count.
it doesn't count. The NBA Cup game doesn't count. So silly. I think that's still nightmare. So goofy to me.
they're going to have 34 wins straight if they win that game, but it actually would be 33 because it would mean that they won a game in that stretch in the NBA Cup, potentially against the New York Knicks in a great Jalen Brunson, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander shootout in clutch moments. What a win! Wouldn't count.
Or they lose it, Tom, or they lose, and it doesn't count. But they get this insane win streak with an asterisk next to it. The game should count. It should count as an extra win. On like if you win the game, it should count as an extra win for the standings. In my opinion, that's like part of the bonus of it. You get a slight edge when it comes to seeding. Not that it's going to matter for OKC. They're going to be the one seed pending like no disaster happens. But like they're going to be the one seed. But for a lot of teams, that extra win could mean something. And so I think it should count. Ultimately, though, you know, we are going to see them face off against the Spurs, and they beat the Lakers on Wednesday night. What was a really gross game for the Lakers. They ended the half not getting back in the transition, and it was just kind of symbolized the whole game for them, where it's like, where is the effort? Where is the intensity? This looks like a team that doesn't want to go to Vegas. That's honestly just the way it looked. Whereas San Antonio played their asses off in the game. 132-119 win. Stephon Castle went off, man. 30 points, 10 boards, 6 assists. The Spurs, they're 8-3 since Wemby went out. Tom, they're 9-3 on the year without Victor, but since he went out 8-3, it's a different guy every night. Sometimes it's Fox, sometimes it's Harrison Barnes. Last night it was Stephon Castle. He looked like a far more complete, fully realized version of himself, I thought, in that game against the Lakers than he did even winning Rookie of the Year last year. Just really impressive to see the leap he's taken.
Yeah, I had a great time watching the Amazon Prime postgame show with De'Aaron Fox joining the crew on the set with Taylor Brooks and Blake Griffin, Steve Nash, and Udonis Haslam. And it was just great to hear De'Aaron Fox talk about how this, you know, this young team is really high IQ, really strong, really smart, and they play well beyond their years. And you look at Stephon Castle and Dylan Harper in this game and the way that they attacked in transition. Look at the transition defense from the Lakers in these highlights. There's no pressure. They're not running back on defense. There was a point in which Luke Kornet just beat Jackson Hayes down the floor like by 50 feet. And they realize the Lakers don't want to run. They're the oldest team by just looking at them and how they play. They look like an old squeaky wheel out there. And Stephon Castle and Dylan Harper, they knew that. So they were running out in transition, and it was the worst defense that the Lakers have put up all season long, giving up over 130 points. And frankly, it could have been more with the way that they were running out in transition. And it's just, they know it. I feel like this team needs an upgrade defensively, someone to, not Marcus Smart, because he's getting up there in age too, where they're going to need a guy who's able to set the tone defensively. Because when you got LeBron and Luka and Austin Reeves, who are great offensively, probably the best offensive trio in the NBA, but defensively, it is rough with those three guys on the floor.
Yeah, extremely rough with the Lakers on that side of things. And the Spurs, you know, continuing to excel without Victor Wembanyama. There was, you know, some noise that he'd play earlier in the week against the Pelicans. There's some hope he'd play on Wednesday against the Lakers. He didn't. It sounds like things are pointing towards him returning on Saturday against Oklahoma City, which... this is a dream matchup, Tom, if Victor doesn't indeed play, because Wemby against Chet, that rivalry continues to grow. The San Antonio Spurs blossoming potentially as the next great challenger for Oklahoma City. This could be a long-term rivalry in the NBA, OKC versus San Antonio, Victor versus Chet. And we'll see like how these guys develop on each side of things in the years to come. But the Spurs are looking damn good, dude. And if Wemby does play Saturday, this will be the first time all year we see the Spurs with Wemby and all three guards, De'Aaron Fox, Dylan Harper, and Stephon Castle, because when Fox returned, Harper was out injured at the time. And so those guys are playing great. Mitch Johnson, head coach of the Spurs, is doing a really good job staggering those lineups with those guys. We haven't even seen all three on the floor at once, Tom. I mean, it's been Fox, Castle, or Harper independently, or just the duo. so far this year that he hasn't thrown out all three at all. I mean, he's staggering them and every lineup is excelling. If you look at the on-off numbers, all of them, it's like +5 for just Fox, plus 6.8 for Fox plus Castle. Every combination except Fox and Harper is a big plus. And so this is going to be the first time, though, we're going to see this team, assuming Victor comes back, with their megastar, Victor Wembanyama. And I can't wait because, boy, what a test it'll be against the Thunder. It's almost unfair in a way for him to come back in this game, but there's no better game to do it than to come back against the Oklahoma City Thunder.
Yeah, I of course, am rooting for that to happen. I want to make sure that he's coming back when he's extra ready. You know, we're seeing a lot of players, you know, historically come back from a calf strain and things go sideways quickly. You talk about Kevin Durant in the 2019 NBA Finals, Damian Lillard coming back from his blood clot in his calf and then tearing his Achilles. I want to just make sure that he's ready to come back. And it's a huge game, of course. And it's great that they're going to have a day off before the game and after the game to make sure he doesn't have to play in a back-to-back, which is what it should be in the NBA, is that there shouldn't be any back-to-backs in the schedule. So you have a guy like Wemby who's able to make a sound decision about whether it's right to come back and not have to worry about a back-to-back situation. Because in the Cup, at this stage, you're not going to have any back-to-backs in this, just like the NBA playoffs. And so for Wemby, I can't wait. And I just, you know, I did this post up for TomTheFinder.com on Monday talking about the star play availability rates. It's just, it hasn't gotten back to last year or the standard around 80, 85% of star availability and playing. And I just hate that you have to do that preamble there, Kev. Like, we haven't seen these guys play together yet, and it's mid-December. We haven't seen full squad OKC. We haven't seen full squad San Antonio. Heck, we haven't even seen full squad Houston, considering Fred VanVleet is out with a torn ACL. And so, as much as I am amped to go see
Wemby,
they're
better without him.
Yeah, we've been on that for a while. Team Reed Shepherd. So this is what one of those cases where it's like, I am excited, but it shouldn't be this way. It shouldn't be that we're waiting until mid-December to see these guys all playing together. And it's just another reason why this injury crisis in the NBA, it unfortunately is part of the conversation. I want to see these two guys playing every time that they have that game against each other, OKC and the Spurs. And it's dating back to even before they were in the NBA with the international play, I remember watching that game between Chet and Wemby and just seeing the future. And I just want more of those. And I just worry that all the back-to-backs in the schedule, we just don't get enough of these stars playing against each other. And I hope that we see it on Saturday.
Yeah. I mean, look, we have a lot of stars right now not on track to play 65 games. And it's unfortunate for fans, you know, attending games, watching games on TV, that we're not able to get some of these players, these star players out there with any consistency. And it's partially, in my opinion, due to the schedule. I don't care what the NBA said. They responded to an Athletic article earlier today, actually. Did you see this, Tom? NBA PR on X responded to...
Yeah.
John Hollinger article. Yeah, the NBA PR sent out a post. They said the Athletic's suggestion that an increase in games missed by star players is related to the early season schedule is inaccurate and misleading. And then Mike Bass, the NBA chief communications officer, goes on a bit longer, disputing Hollinger's article about that. John Hollinger's premise that the NBA Cup has led to a denser schedule resulting in more player injuries is simply not supported by the data. And it goes on. We don't need to read all of it, but the NBA pushing back on the early season increase in injuries having anything to do with the NBA Cup. And it says the reality is the NBA played roughly the same number of games through 42 days this season, 308, as last season, 307. Further, those numbers are consistent with pre-Cup years, 308 in 2022, 313 in 2021.
Yeah, I'd have to look at what the numbers here are. But if you talk to athletic trainers around the league, it's hard to pinpoint any sort of cause and correlation, because all the injury reporting, there's all sorts of misinformation, not consistent injury reporting. And so the term that I've heard a lot is garbage in, garbage out, is that like anytime you're using this injury data, There's a lot of gray area about the kinds of injuries, right? Whether this is a calf strain or an Achilles issue. Not only that, like, multiple injuries are not typically listed in the injury report, so you're not getting super accurate information on that point. But here the NBA is saying that an unnaturally heavy schedule. The reality is the NBA played roughly the same number of games through 42 days this season, 308, as last season. I mean, I'd have to look at this, but my numbers are showing that star players, the games lost due to injury is way up this season, right? And much of that is because of things that happened last year. Is Damian Lillard, Tyrese Haliburton, and Jason Tatum are hurt for the season potentially, and you can't throw that out. Like, I'm sorry. Like, if you're doing a report on car accidents, and you would say, hey, just excluding fatal car accidents, car accidents are down. It's like, no, you can't do that. You can't just say, like, we're going to toss aside the fact that all these players are missing games this season because of injuries that happened last year. I think it's relevant that we're not seeing Jason Tatum in Boston games on national TV. We're not seeing Tyrese Haliburton playing for the reigning champ, Eastern Conference champ, Indiana Pacers. And so this is, I mean, if you talk behind closed doors with teams, the schedule, and Steve Kerr said this on the record, back in May, talking to Yahoo Sports, and since then has talked regularly about this topic, is the schedule is what it is. And until teams and until owners and until the TV partners come together and recognize that this system can't be sustainable, to have Victor Wembanyama and De'Aaron Fox and Dylan Harper and Stephon Castle not playing together, or the Oklahoma City Thunder players not playing together, we go around the league. And we just haven't seen star trios, star duos, or even stars suiting up for their team. Like, Philadelphia, what are they, Kev? Like, what are the Philadelphia 76ers? We have no idea, because they're not playing together because they're too injured. So yeah, I just think that this system is broken and we need to do something about it.
I mean, it's very complicated, because I think, you know, the NBA, clearly there's an uptick in injuries, and there's pace is up. There's a lot of factors that could be contributing to it. But, like, if you also look at the NFL, Achilles injuries are way up in the NFL as well. It's ticked up every 5 to 7 years or so. And it's blossomed, unfortunately, into a big thing in the NFL as well, with a lot of talk about why are there so many more Achilles injuries happening now than there were just 20 years ago or 10 years ago, for that matter. And I don't know if it's, you know, longer careers. I don't know all the factors here. It is a longer schedule in the NFL as well. I don't know I'm not a doctor here. I don't think even anybody knows the exact reason why. But you saw Daniel Jones, the Colts quarterback, tear his Achilles last week, when it kind of a compensation injury, because he had an injury to the other leg. So it's hard to know exactly what exactly the factors are. But this is why, to your point, Tom, the Spurs need to be overly cautious for when Victor returns. You can't risk him rupturing his Achilles. You need to be extremely careful for when he returns and when you decide to bring him back. And ultimately, it does sound like, you know, a little bit of over a month absence is what it will be for Victor, assuming he does play on Saturday against the Spurs. What is your prediction for that game, Tom? Assuming Victor Wembanyama is playing for San Antonio, I'm picking OKC. I'd assume you will too, but are you going to zag here?
No, I'd pick OKC as well. They're just humming. I think the stat is that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has played in 11 fourth quarters of his 24 games that he's played this season, even when he was out the other day.
That's crazy.
They just blew the doors off of their opponent without Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. So even if you want to say, like, hey, you know, they've had pretty much healthy Shai all year long, which, you know, not guaranteed. Again, star players are playing about 65% of their games this season. And Shai has played just about every single game. But even it doesn't matter. It doesn't seem to matter, Kev, who's playing for OKC. It's just plug and play. And no one can seem to stop them. The defense is that good, historically way better relative to league average than we've ever seen. I mean, through 25 games or so, it's just they're in a different league, it seems like. And, you know, just another note on the Wemby thing is, I talked to two surgeons who work on Achilles tears calf injuries, foot problems, two leading doctors, one of which you might have heard of, Dr. Richard Ferkel, who repaired Klay Thompson's Achilles tear. And actually, Klay Thompson a few months ago gave Dr. Ferkel a championship ring from 22 because he was like, who would have thought that after my Achilles tear and the ACL tear that I'd ever be the second leading scorer on a championship team again? And he gave him a championship ring to Richard Ferkel. And he's also a guy that's worked on, he repaired DeMarcus Cousins' Achilles tear, Rodney Hood. He worked on Steph Curry's ankles. Pablo Torre did a great story on that a few years ago for ESPN the magazine. He's on a committee with other surgeons, PhDs, and researchers appointed by the league, the NBA league office, as he said, quote to me, in a story that I just posted for Yahoo Sports, Dr. Ferkel said the NBA is studying this very carefully, the uptick in Achilles injuries and the relationship with calf strains, because we saw Tyrese Haliburton come back from a calf strain that he suffered in game 5 in the NBA Finals, labor through it in game 6, force a game 7, and then tear his Achilles. And what he told me was the NBA is very concerned right now about the issue. And all the doctors are very concerned because of this fact. Jeff Stotts, the injury expert, told me his data has over 400 calf strains in his database dating over a decade in the NBA. Do you want to guess how many of them directly led to Achilles tears?
15%.
Over 400 calf strains, only two of them have directly preceded an Achilles tear. And you can probably guess it. 2019 NBA Finals, Kevin Durant, and 2025 NBA Finals, Tyrese Haliburton. And yet we're seeing the time lost due to injury on calf strains triple since last year. So many teams are cautious, like you said, and I'm expressing caution here, as I don't want to see Victor Wembanyama out for an Achilles tear. But the fact of the matter is, only two out of over 400 calf strains have directly led to an Achilles tear. So when I talk to these surgeons, they're trying to make sense of what's going on here, because teams are holding out players from calf strains longer than they did typically. And now we're seeing, wait a minute. Okay, so Achilles tear, we had 7 Achilles tears last year. How many of them could be directly attributable to weakness in the calf or somewhere other in the posterior chain? And the fact of the matter is, it's a big mystery right now, Kev. Like, the uptick in Achilles tears and calf strains, they're all trying to study it. Technology companies are trying to race to try to figure out what is going on in the league, why 65% of star players are playing rather than 100%. This is a huge mystery in the league, and I think there's a lot of factors. It's not just one, but the game has changed, and we can put our head in the sand and say, hey, we can keep playing 82 games and pretend like this is just going to solve itself. But I think all hands on deck, the NBA is trying to figure out, the doctors are trying to figure out, the teams are trying to figure out, and most of all, the players are trying to figure out how to have a long career in today's fast-paced NBA. And the way the three-point shot has changed the dimensions of the game, very different than what we grew up watching, Kev. And you're seeing a lot of confusion around the league. What is going on here that we see Giannis, Ja Morant, and Victor Wembanyama out for multiple weeks with calf strains? I think people are terrified of what they saw with Tyrese Haliburton.
And understandably so, terrified of that. 2 of 400, a little bit lower than I would have anticipated there, a lot lower than I would have anticipated. So very interesting stat there. I look forward to reading your full piece over on yahoosports.com. The other game we will get on Saturday is the Knicks and the Magic, because the Magic beat the Heat, the Knicks beat the Raptors on Tuesday night. This is going to be a fun matchup, Tom, because Orlando, early in the season, all the conversation was about, whoa, what's wrong with their defense? They fixed it. In recent weeks, they have the number 2 defensive rating in the NBA behind Oklahoma City. The Knicks are still buzzing on offense as well. They faced the Magic 3 times this year. The Magic won the first 2. The Knicks won the 3rd game, and that's the one where Franz Wagner got hurt. He'll be out, another injury to an all-star caliber player, out on Saturday. What's your general thought, your first thought with this Knicks-Magic matchup on Saturday, Tom?
It's going to be great. And I think people are imagining like old school Knicks magic, just grinded out ugly basketball. But the way that Desmond Bane has kind of transformed this offense, he had 37 points in the quarterfinal, led the team his third 35-point game of the season. And the offense, just with both Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner, just hasn't really taken off in ways you would think with two stars like that. But Desmond Bane, whether he's playing with Franz or he's playing with Paolo, they're a much better offense because Desmond Bane is such a more dynamic player and a guy that can really go off and lead your offense. Then on the other side, the number two schedule-adjusted offense in the NBA is the New York Knicks under Mike Brown. The Knicks, typically, you know, when we think of like New York Knicks basketball, it is physical. It is defensive oriented. And they are improved defensively year over year. But this offense is humming, man. Jalen Brunson is scoring a lot more early in transition opportunities. The team is playing more up-tempo, spraying out to three-pointers in ways they just really never did under Tibbs. The greatest year-over-year increase in three-point attempts is from your New York Knicks under Mike Brown, adding about 7 three-point attempts to their ledger this season. And they're getting Karl-Anthony Towns attacking downhill. He hasn't even shot well this season, and yet they're the number two offense. So this is going to be, I think, a high-scoring affair. Yes, Orlando is a team that loves to kind of grind it out, play more physical, crash the offensive boards. But this New York Knicks team, man, they are super fun to watch. They're doing a lot more driving kicks, a lot more getting into the corners. And it's a Mike Brown offense, and it's a lot more fun to watch, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's been a hell of a lot more fun to watch. And I think you mentioned it, how people might assume this could be a grinded out game because of Orlando's defense and how the Knicks have been historically. But Orlando's offense has been a lot better recently. I mean, the first, you know, bucket Desmond Bane had in that 37-point game, they're down 13 points at the time. The Heat got off to a great start in the game. It was a pick and roll run with Wendell Carter, and then it transitioned into a dribble handoff. And Desmond Bane, the way he was moving and zagging and juking to create a little bit of space away from Davion Mitchell, the comfortability he has now with some of these Magic players, those early season struggles he had, and he really sucks to start the year. Yeah. But he has been stellar in recent weeks. And like I said, that first play, the chemistry with Wendell Carter, when I had him on my podcast before the season, he talked about how, you know, Wendell Carter's a guy nobody talks about, you know, but he's kind of our X factor. It feels like he saw the chemistry developing at that time with him. And now we're starting to see that happen on the court with the way in which he's performing in these two-man actions with Wendell Carter and others on the team.
Yeah, he's one of the most underrated players in the league, Kev. Wendell Carter Jr. is one of the best rim protectors in the league. You look at the numbers, he's always top five in rim protection, defensive field goal percentage around the rim when he's nearby. And then on the offensive boards, the screening, he just does a lot of the dirty work that you need to be a successful NBA team on both ends of the floor. And he's not 7'2". You're not going to be able to pick him out on the floor and be like, oh, that's clearly one of the best inside guys in the league. But he reminds me a lot of Isaiah Stewart, and just like, he's a dog out there. He's going to rough you up, and he's going to be physical, and you're going to hate going against that guy. And Desmond Bane loves playing with those guys, loves guys who are going to get mixed up. They're going to mess with the other team, get under their skin. And that's the kind of guy you need on your squad. I do think that like things get really interesting with the Orlando Magic, right? If they continue to be a 500 team with Paolo and Franz on the floor, but better when they're separate, I think this Orlando Magic team has to entice any sort of calls about Paolo Banchero. I would probably say his value around the league is probably higher than Franz Wagner. I might be wrong about it. I'm curious what you think about this. But the way that Desmond Bane provides that two-way game and the spacing, I almost feel like Paolo Banchero is like the fourth most valuable player on this team. Like, you got Franz, Jalen Suggs, who's been great. Yeah. Yeah. And I would put him at fourth. And I know that's a controversial opinion, considering Paolo Banchero is the star of the team, the face of the franchise. But to me, when you look at the on-court data, the box score numbers, I think overrate Paolo Banchero. And I would say I'd rather have Desmond Bane, Franz Wagner, and Jalen Suggs, and then whomever they could get if another team, like let's say Giannis. Let's say the Milwaukee Bucks call Orlando and ask for Paolo Banchero. I would entice that. I would that's be like, yeah, I would feel pretty good about that because I've reached, it seems like, a ceiling with Franz and Paolo. And we'll see. I think Franz Wagner got some good news with his ankle. It looked a lot worse than I thought the diagnosis was. But I just feel like this Orlando Magic team has another level it can get to. And I just wonder if Paolo's a guy.
I mean, you mentioned dogs, Jalen Suggs, Anthony Black, some of the guards on that Magic team. I mean, Jalen Suggs is tough, man. I mean, he's just such a good basketball player, but just straight up good. And I love watching him play, and I look forward to seeing that Suggs-Brunson matchup. I'm sure they'll match up plenty of times on Saturday. What's your prediction for the game, Tom, between the Knicks and the Magic on Saturday? That's the early one we have in the NBA Cup on Saturday.
Yeah, with no Franz, I'm going to go with the Knicks. Knicks, OKC in the final. That would be juicy.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the Knicks as well in that one. Though, Desmond Bane, if he has a massive game again, you cannot rule out the Magic despite not having Franz in that game. But Banchero, too. We saw Banchero step up in the postseason last year. This will be his fourth game back without Franz Wagner. He's been okay since he came back. Maybe this is kind of his breakout game as well. So that's what we get. You and I both have the Thunder and the Knicks in the final, which isn't until Tuesday. So they have 2 days off after the games on Saturday, Sunday and Monday off, then the final on Tuesday night in Las Vegas. I mean, we're both picking OKC in that as well. I mean, it's just hard to go the other way. You're a Knicks homer if you're picking the Knicks. If you're picking any team against OKC right now. So we'll see what happens. I do think for the NBA Cup, Tom, it's exciting because OKC, I've said it forever. I said it on the pod just earlier this week. I really think the Cup generates meaning and tradition the first time we see a team win the NBA Cup, have the best regular season record, and then go on to win the NBA Finals. And OKC has a chance to do that and break the regular season win record this season. And so if OKC wins it, that starts off a run. They come in off of finals. If they win the cup, they continue their dominance. We'll see if they indeed do get the best record in the regular season, either this year or all time. And we'll see come April, May, June if they are able to go back to back. But I really think these are four good teams for the NBA to have in the cup right now. And with OKC there, of course, playing at the level they are, this is where I think it can start to have meaning. That's just the way I feel about it. I know a lot of fans disagree. Where are you at with that, Tom? Do you agree with me there?
Yeah, I think what really hurt last year was when Giannis won it and he didn't want to celebrate. I think that really hurt a lot of the prestige of the game. Everything that the NBA had been building with the courts and with the commercials, the marketing, everything built up to put this game on a pedestal, and Giannis downplayed it and said, "We haven't won anything yet." And I get it. The idea of like, look, our goal is to win an NBA championship. But as someone who's from Greece and grew up in Europe, he should understand that like there are different cups, you know, whether it's soccer or other sports, that they're mid-season tournaments that you can get up and place a value on that so fans can get excited about this and get excited about you winning the NBA Cup final. So I do think that the NBA has a great thing going here with the midseason tournament. I think they should knock down the number of games in the schedule to make sure that this is its own separate tournament and not have to kind of like awkwardly splice it into the season. Might get there in the next 5 years, but we're not there yet. And I think fans, you know, we live and breathe and die with basketball, NBA basketball. But just talking to friends and buddies who watch football and other sports, it's very confusing. And I think when the NBA figures out a way to have a 32-team tournament and have just stop the schedule and just do this, the NBA Cup, I think then it takes another leap in terms of the place in the NBA in the sports zeitgeist. And I do think if OKC wins this, it will legitimize this run a little bit more, but I think we're going to be dogged by the whole, like, is that a real win? Is that a continuous streak? Is that all that stuff? Because like you said, if they lose this, dude, if they lose the NBA Cup final, but continue to win, it's going to be on PTI, leading PTI, like the illegitimacy of this win streak because they lost, but it didn't count.
Yeah, we'll see how it all plays out. We shall see with that. And we'll be right back after this break. There are other games being played, Tom. Tonight on Thursday and on Friday, you and I are going to go back and forth on what we're going to be watching for with some of these games on Thursday and Friday. I want to start off with Ja Morant and the Memphis Grizzlies, Tom, because you may have seen that Ja Morant is giving away 250 tickets to fans, or a pair of tickets, so 500 total tickets for Friday's game against the Utah Jazz. Ja was doubtful for Sunday's game with a calf strain, one of the many players out with calf strains. It seems like things are pointing towards Ja coming back on Friday. This is a welcome back party for him, but it's also a litmus test because the Grizzlies were 4-10 to start the year with Ja Morant. A quick reminder, early in the year, those first 14 games, Ja Morant shot 26% of his total shots at the rim. That was a career low. He made a career worst 55% of those. He shot a career worst 16.7% from three. He had a career high 3.8 turnovers per game. He was stationary off ball. He was targeted defensively. He got benched in the fourth quarter of a game against the Lakers. He undercut the coaching staff after the game, post-game, with microphones in his face. And at the time, the offense was sluggish. The new pick-and-roll heavy offense that was supposed to be for Ja wasn't working. And the tracking data, going back to earlier in the year, they made the fewest passes per half-court possession of any team in the NBA. And since he got hurt, that skyrocketed up to third. They're third in the NBA in passes per half-court possessions. They go from last to third just by removing Ja Morant. And they've won seven of those last 10 games without him. Zach Edey is back and playing at a really high level on both ends. Cedric Coward continues to look really good as a rookie. Jalen Wells is playing great. Cam Spencer is playing great. So it's lottery picks playing well. It's second rounders playing well. The ball's moving. Pace is high. And so Ja Morant comes back now. And what needs to change? He needs to make quicker decisions. He can't be pounding the air out of the ball. He's near the NBA in time of possession and dribbles per touch, but he's near the bottom in efficiency. He's just got to fit in more with this team because at one point, Ja for the Grizzlies, he had to be their savior. But right now, Memphis needs a teammate. And unfortunately for him, between the suspensions, the lack of self-awareness, the comments he's made publicly, and the inability to adapt, Morant's shown zero interest in being that teammate. And so if he comes back and if he hijacks the offense, if he staggers the development of this youth again, the Grizzlies are going to have to trade Ja. This is his last chance here, Tom. It's his last chance to prove himself as a member of the Grizzlies, for being part of this new era, this new future here, and also to prove himself to any other team that might have interest as well. So he bought tickets for the fans. That's awesome. It's great. They're going to, you know, have 500 people there excited to see him. But he's got to earn patience here from the other fans and from the organization. And this is the moment we're really going to find out if Ja Morant has it in him starting on Friday with his return.
Yeah, after watching that game against the Blazers and not noticing them missing Ja Morant in the least, you know, just the ball was moving. They were so good. And it looked like the chemistry was as good as I've seen a Memphis Grizzlies team in a long, long time. And it is no coincidence that Ja Morant was on the bench for that game. I mean, if you're the Grizzlies, I mean, you got to be so excited about the future, right? Like, you've got Cedric Coward and Santi Aldama, and you've got Zach Edey and this young core there. And it's really odd because I feel like they're the face of the team right now. Like, those young guys are what gets you excited to watch the Memphis Grizzlies. And it's not Ja Morant or Jaren Jackson Jr., who, by the way, Jaren Jackson Jr. is very thankful for Ja Morant and all his antics this year and the injury this year, because it's taken a lot of scrutiny off of him. He's having one of the most disappointing seasons in the league. He got his extension in the offseason, 22 points a game last year, down to 17 this year. Just not the same player. And Zach Edey, it seems like he's almost taking the throne from Jaren Jackson as like the guy inside for Memphis. And I think, like, when you look at this Memphis Grizzlies team, who are you wanting to build around? Is it Ja Morant still? Is it Jaren Jackson Jr. still? Or is it the young guys? And I would argue, if I'm a Grizzlies fan, I want to see them all play together at least for a little while before I come to this determination. But I got to tell you, they're a lot more fun when Cedric Howard and Zach Edey are running the show than Ja Morant and Jaren Jackson Jr. for a long time.
There's a real chance, Tom. I mean, like I said, this is his chance. Like Ja coming back Friday and Jaren Jackson shoot too. I mean, like you said, all the attention on Ja has removed it from Jaren Jackson Jr. But for both of those guys, I want to see them all play together as well. I'm 100% with you there, but it's very possible that if this doesn't go well, if Ja doesn't change, if he's slowing things down again, it's very possible in a couple of weeks here, I'm on this podcast with you saying the Memphis Grizzlies need to blow it up 100%. They have to do it before the deadline. Trade Ja, trade Jaren. It's very possible that that's where we'll be at. And I would bet on that being what ends up happening. I have very little faith in Ja Morant's ability to adapt to this offense that they're running. I don't think he's shown a lot of qualities in changing that. I've, for so many years, you know, I've always talked about, well, if Russ does this, if Russ changes, Russell Westbrook, that is, if this guy does that, if this guy does that, because you do see players evolve, but a lot of the times you don't. And with Ja Morant, we're going to find out what category is he in. Is he a guy that can evolve and become somebody who keeps the ball moving and makes quick decisions, or, you know, looking for the secondary assist, the hockey assist, and making that extra pass? Or is he going to be a guy that continues dribbling the ball a lot till the end of the clock? And that worked for him in the past to great heights. He was a great player at his best. He was one of the top 15 or so guys in the NBA at his peak, and it worked for him. But is he going to show an ability to evolve from that, considering he's just not that guy anymore? It's just the reality of the situation. He's not the same athlete he was then. He's not as explosive. He's not as careless, which was part of his superpower when going to the rim and attacking the rim, avoiding injury a bit more. Now, he talked about how he's not going to dunk anymore a year ago. And so can he evolve from that? I don't think he's shown much of an ability to do so, but we'll see. We're going to see starting on Friday.
Yeah, this is a guy that desperately needs a floor spacing arsenal, a weapon beyond the arc, because teams are going to go under that pick and roll. They're going to pack the paint. And then what are you, Ja Morant? Like, if you don't have that superpower finishing at the rim, he was the guy who was leading the league in points in the paint not too long ago. And now he's got three dunks on the season in 12 games? And that's just a different player. And so I guess he's going to watch like J. Kidd tape and just how to be able to have a late blooming three-point shot, knockdown three-point shot at this point in his career. It's very rare to find. It's certainly possible. But what is Steph Curry without a three-point shot?
Real quick, Tom, like you say late stage career, he's 26. We're already talking about this. You know what I mean?
I know.
He's 26. That's the twisted part of our conversation here. We're talking about Ja needing to evolve. Like, he's 36, but he's 26. But that's the reality of the situation. That is the reality here with him.
Yeah, it's just if you're not willing to drive in the paint, or you can't drive in the paint like you used to and rise above the defense and be the early Derrick Rose, the prime Russell Westbrook, the early Ja Morant, then you're going to have to figure out ways to be effective from the perimeter and space and not have teams pack the paint when you got Zach Edey out on the floor. So it becomes a lot tougher for Ja Morant to be an all-star in today's NBA when he's not got the nitro boosters and basically the ability to get into the paint at will and finish above the defense. So like I said, if Steph Curry didn't have a three-point shot, he'd still be an effective player because of his ability to finish and get into the paint and his handles. But he's not an all-star. And that's the same thing with Ja Morant. If he's not the guy who's dunking all over everybody and finishing acrobatic moves around the rim and getting downhill relentlessly, then he's just another guy.
Yeah, just another guy. Tom, what's one of the things you're looking forward to watching on Thursday or Friday?
Oh, man. Thursday night. I know this is not going to be at the top of everyone's list to watch Blazers Pelicans. But, dude, we've been on this for a while, and I feel like we need a Derek Queen tracker with this podcast, because a 30-point triple-double in his last game, this is insane what he's doing. I've said that he's Jambalaya Jokic because he's just got this Jokic, Shangoon-type feel for the game. He's beefy. He's got such great passing skill. People try to block him around the rim, and then he does these little flip shots like he's Shangoon or Jokic. I mean, Derek Queen, he's he's must watch TV. And it's so weird to say about a guy who's playing on a 3-22 team with Zion Williamson in street clothes. But dude, I love watching Derek Queen play basketball. And shout out to Troy Weaver, who was very instrumental in selecting Derek Queen, trading up, of course, with one of the most gutsy trades we've ever seen a front office make, not protecting a first-round pick, sending it to Atlanta.
Does Troy Weaver get the credit for that, but Joe Dumars gets the criticism for it? Is that what this
is? Well, considering, I think Troy Weaver has the connection to Maryland and the D.C. area, right? Joe Dumars has
Troy
to be
Weaver,
the one
you're
like,
a genius.
Wait.
Joe Dumars, you're an idiot. Is that what this is?
That'd be an interesting press conference when it's like, wait, who's going to take credit for that trade? But like, like Bill Simmons said, if there's like a club that can both at once praise Derek Queen, but also say that was a disaster of a trade, I'm there too. It is a crazy, crazy story in the NBA, but Derek Queen is awesome, man. Let's not ignore the fact that he has been every bit the player that he needed to be to make people forget about that trade.
Yeah, I mean, I it's totally true. I think it's completely reasonable to be in that bucket you described, thinking it was a terrible trade, but also thinking Derek Queen is a really great player. And we'll see. He's only 20 years old at this point. A long way to grow. He's not even hitting threes yet. He's a high touch player. We saw the game winner he had for Maryland in March Madness, the touch on that leaning floater. He's a great touch player. You're seeing it early this season already, as you described. Only 11% from three so far this year.
80% shooter at the line.
Yeah, 80% guy from the line.
Which always is a good marker of ability to one day become a plus 3-point shooter. And I have a lot of belief in Derek Queen. Ability to do what Jokic and Şengün did is become a much better shooter because that touch translates from 30 feet out.
100%. That's going to happen at some point in his career. So we are seeing just a baby version of Derek Queen. We'll see over the years to come what he becomes as a potential star-level player. I'm looking forward to watching the Pistons and the Hawks playing, because this is a battle of some 80s suitors, potentially. Shams Charania over at ESPN reported that the Pistons, Hawks, and Raptors are expected to be suitors for Anthony Davis should he actually become available. Would you trade for AD if you're any of those teams, Tom?
I know what Rich Paul says about that. You know, that was interesting. Rich Paul going on his new podcast with Max Kellerman and saying, you know, feel like Jalen Johnson is a guy that Milwaukee should be calling about in a potential Giannis trade. And he, you know, says, got cards on the table. I represent Jalen Johnson at Clutch Sports, which has to be, you know, as a journalist, Rich Paul is out here, you know, being making sure that he does not, hide his biases on this. But it was interesting to hear that conversation.
Also, Tom, Jalen Johnson from Wisconsin, too.
Interesting. Yeah, you're right about that. And that's why I think the Tyler Hero conversations or Con Knipple is off the table, I think, in those talks, which is a crazy thing to say. But Charlotte is not a great pairing with Giannis and Antetokounmpo anyway because of the looming extension, and you got to make him happy. But if I'm the Atlanta Hawks, I don't know. Do I keep riding with this? Am I championship contender with Giannis and Antetokounmpo? I don't think I am. I don't think I am if I have Trae Young questionable going forward with his injuries and his effectiveness in the postseason. But if I'm the Pistons, I think I'm a lot closer than the Atlanta Hawks are. I think I'm a lot closer with the big men and Isaiah Stewart and Jalen Duren. I know you probably have to give up something in order to get Giannis Antetokounmpo, but if I have Cade Cunningham paired with Giannis Antetokounmpo and you surround those two guys with shooters, whew, that's a title contender for sure. Atlanta, I'm a little bit iffy on.
Yeah, Atlanta, I'm very iffy on. I wouldn't want to give up Jalen Johnson. I'd give up Trey, but I'm not giving up Jalen Johnson in a Giannis trade. I just don't think my team is there yet if I'm the Hawks. If I'm the Raptors, I have no interest. I don't think he makes much sense for Toronto. But with the Pistons, they should be after AD. Now, the Pistons should go after Anthony Davis. And I think with them, they have the ability to sweeten deals with all of their future picks. They have all their future picks in a deal. So they could give up players like Tobias Harris plus Caris LeVert, and then one of Ivy, Thompson, or Holland. And then the picks can be adjusted to fit what makes sense there for them. And I think you look at you look at them throughout this entire season, Stewart and Duren, their two big lineup, but we saw a lot when Tobias Harris was out, had a 129.4 offensive rating, a 113.8 defensive rating, a plus 15.6 net in 168 minutes. There was something to that two big lineup, something there. And so I think they should continue to explore that by going to get an AD or another big, because I think come playoff time, that lineup flexibility for them could be highly, highly valuable in making it to the NBA Finals. And then once you're there, who knows what could happen in a seven-game series against OKC, or if OKC were to get upset, you might be very happy you have AD at that point. So I do think I'm with you there, Tom, that the Pistons should go for it. I think I can't even think of a counter against it other than, well, AD's injury prone. That's it. Like, that's literally it. But fit-wise for the team, AD makes perfect sense. He fits with Cade. He fits with these other young guys. He fits next to Duren or Stewart, or he can play alone at the five. It's just, I think that that's a move. The East is open, man. They got to go for it.
I was doing that whole thing about Giannis and didn't realize that we were talking about AD, but I think that same principles apply, is that I don't think I'm ready to trade all of my stuff if I'm Atlanta. I'd rather have Jalen Johnson, younger, more effective, plays downhill, much better passer, and fits the timeline of, like, we don't have to put all our chips in the middle for Anthony Davis, and the same thing with Pistons. I would give up Isaiah Stewart maybe for AD, but I would keep Duren and Cade Cunningham and try to figure out a way to keep those two guys intact if I'm going to trade for Anthony Davis. I think they can do it. Like you said, with the picks going to Dallas, it would make a lot of sense.
Tom, what's another thing you're looking forward to watching this weekend, or rather Thursday and Friday?
Oh, man, it's weird. The whole Sacramento Kings thing is kind of this, like, we're all rubbernecking the Sacramento Kings this season. But can we just, like, talk about the fact that Russell Westbrook is still getting triple-doubles like every other night?
I picked him up in fantasy. For some reason, he was a free agent in a high-score league that I'm in. I was like, I'm going to pick up Russ.
Russell Westbrook for the Sacramento Kings in 2025 is a fantasy darling. Like, think about this. Like, he's going to get his triple-double numbers, and it doesn't impact winning. But at this point with the Sacramento Kings, I have no idea what they're doing. I don't know why Keon Ellis is buried in the doghouse of Doug Christie. This was one of the best defenders on their team, if not the best perimeter defender on their team. Doug Christie keeps talking about how he wants defense, and yet he's rolling Russell Westbrook out there for 30 minutes a night to go get his triple-doubles. And now you got them, the Sacramento Kings, going against Denver, a team they've already beaten this season. Russ going against his former team. It's always been spicy when Russ is going against his former teams. So I'm looking forward to Russell Westbrook having this kind of like renaissance as the guy, with late career renaissance as the guy for this very, very, just very disappointing Sacramento Kings team. But he's been, man, I mean, I've been harsh on Russell Westbrook over the years. I just don't think he's as much of a winning player as his box scores numbers suggest. But when you're the Sacramento Kings, there's not much to get excited about this season. But watching Russ go for triple doubles and playing against his former team in the Denver Nuggets, that's going to be interesting. I just want to give a shout out to Russell Westbrook doing this at 37 years old.
Yeah, I mean, look, if I were a Kings fan, and thankfully I didn't grow up a Kings fan. Yeah. No disrespect, but I wouldn't have fun watching Russ. I'd hate watching these old guys. When you juxtapose it against the promise of Maxime Reyneau as a second round big man prospect rookie, if you want more minutes for Neek Clifford, your rookie first round draft pick, I'm like, where's Keon Ellis in all of this? Keon Ellis is still in his mid 20s. He's 25 years old. Why is he getting shorted for minutes here? That's what I'd be wondering about if I were a Kings fan. When I try to imagine myself, you know, watching this team, I'd be like, yeah, Russ putting up numbers in another loss. And like, when your team stinks like this, what's winning is feeling progress and feeling like you're building something. This isn't fun. This isn't winning. They're going nowhere. They're aimless right now. And to me, that's like the worst place to be as a sports fan, is feeling like you don't have a direction, Tom. And so I hope at some point this season the Kings pull the plug on this whole situation, trade away Russ, trade away Sabonis if they're able to, trade away some of these vets, DeMar DeRozan, and just build with your quality young players. They have some really good youth there on their team. And, you know, pray to God that you get a top pick. You know, just pray. Because, I mean, right now they have the fourth worst record, tied for the third worst record in the NBA, actually. They got a shot, man. They got a shot to get a potential savior in the draft. So that's what I want. I don't want these old guys winning games by accident in March and April and screwing that all up.
Do you want to know the two oldest teams in the NBA are? Minutes weighted, oldest two teams?
I mean, Kings, I'm assuming Kings are one of them, considering you're asking.
Yeah. Yeah, Kings 6-18, Clippers 6-18. Yeah.
Oh my God, it's a young man's game.
6-18, and is that the takeaway?
Right.
It is, and I think it has to do with the pace of the play. If you're gonna play defense like OKC, you better be young. You can't hang. It's a young man's game, and even that takes a toll on the body. The two teams that have the most games lost due to injury this season are the Pacers and the Oklahoma City Thunder. So even if you're going deep into the postseason, you're gonna get banged up because the game is too hard. There's too much speed in the NBA to sustain 100 games in the year. And for the Clippers and for Sacramento, good luck. Good luck having an old, over the hill on the back nine of your career team and still being able to keep up in today's NBA.
Yeah, we're going to see an old team get back on Friday. The Stephen Curry and Draymond Green are likely back for the Warriors against the Timberwolves. So Anthony Edwards has been playing very well for kind of a weird Wolves team so far. That's another game I look forward to from the non-NBA Cup games. But Tom, the NBA Cup on Saturday with the semifinals, I am very, very excited for that. I'll be in Las Vegas for those games. Hopefully it's a good crowd for both of those, especially the night game. From what I remember, I was there the first year for the Cup 2 years ago. The early game was just kind of like the hardcore NBA fans, but it was, you know, scattered seats and all that. The night game had a bit better energy, so Spurs, Thunder at night, Knicks, Magic in the afternoon. I'm very, very excited, Tom. I hope you have a good weekend, man. Thanks for joining.
Yeah, I'm locked in Thursday night, Denny Abdia watch. And then it's a weird schedule for these teams not in the NBA Cup. I had 2 games in 10 days on the broadcast, and it feels like I'm on vacation somehow. But I'm not, because I've been burning the midnight oil. Go check out the Yahoo Sports article by you, Kev, on Ja Morant, and also on the calf strains, the two scariest words in the NBA right now, calf strain, and what the medical community is saying about this growing and concerning trend. So go check that out on Yahoo, as well as The Big Number and the Blazers broadcast. If you want to check in, Derek Queen watch, Denny Avia watch, got a good one on Thursday night.
Thank you, Tom. Up next, we have James Barlow for another edition of Draft Class. All right, time for another edition of Draft Class, and joining today from NBA Draft Junkies, James Barlow. James, how are you?
I'm good, man. I can't complain. And how are you?
We got some lottery lessons we got to get to, man, because BYU, huge comeback against Clemson at Madison Square Garden. Our producer, Emmy, was in the game. She is a BYU alum. AJ DeBonta lead a big-time comeback against Clemson. They trailed by 22 points in the game. He outscores Clemson himself in the second half of the game. What did you see from DeBonta in this performance against Clemson, James?
He is such a better playmaker than probably what he was advertised as coming out of high school, coming off the AU circuit. And he showed you exactly what I think he can become at the next level, especially like initiating offense and high pick and roll. I want to say in the first half, he got off to a slow start, kind of struggled to create space, create separation. And then they lifted him up from the mid post, and then he started to see the floor. And then that's when he got downhill. And then the second half, he just had a monster game. He controls the pace of the game almost like it's not LeBron level, but you can see that he's very comfortable like dictating. If you send somebody to double team him, he's going to find the open guys. But he threw a number of left-hand passes last night, and like the numbers were crazy. He out-assisted Clemson by himself in the second half. Like that's the tape that they're going to show on draft night when he selected 1, 2, or 3, but he was amazing. I think he's growing as a playmaker, and if he gets to that spot on the low block and he's going to get to the middle, he's going to elevate or he's going to draw a foul, And then if you don't, he can find guys. Like, he has college basketball figured out already, and he's not even 19 yet.
And I feel like the handle is still loose sometimes. Like, the handle isn't what it will be in 3 years, 4 years, 5 years when he's nearing the prime of his career. Like, he's going to get better in those categories. And, like, the offhand passing, as you mentioned, you know, a right-handed player in the final 5 minutes of the game, you know, he found Keita, BYU's big, for, you know, two lob dunks, two lob passes that he made. Then he had that lefty dish off of the isolation on the right side of the floor for a dunk for him. And dude, I just feel like with AJ DiBonsa, he's been dominant scoring so far out of pick and roll. He's 19 out of 34 in pick and rolls, getting to the rim at will. He's dominating from the post, 12 of 20 so far in post-ups. And, you know, you can kind of, you know, ISOs and post-ups can belong in the same category. But in these tough categories, you know, pick and roll and ISOs, post-ups, the dude looks very, very comfortable creating in the half court. And what's the hardest thing? Like, you can find guys that dominate in transition in the open floor in college, but DiBonsa is doing it in the half court against a set defense in tough games, oftentimes down sometimes. Of course, I saw him against UConn in their almost comeback against the Huskies in a TD Garden in Boston. He completed the comeback against Clemson. He's doing it facing adversity as well. And so I think with AJ, I don't know if he'll end up number one. I don't know. I want him to be number one because he's from Brockton, Massachusetts. I'm born and raised in Brockton, Massachusetts. I would love for him to be my number one. I really would, James. I want him to end up my number one. I don't know if he will. But I think he's checking a lot of those boxes so far this year. Is there anything? We talked last time, you mentioned his three-point rate. Do you still look at that as a bit of a concern, or are you kind of looking past it at this point, considering some of the other things you're seeing him doing out there?
I'm going to look past it because I feel like he has college basketball figured out. And even while he's not taking a ton of threes, he's not settling for them. And he's also not, to me, passing as many open threes up as he was early on. Take them and make them. Even in that game against Clemson, I think it was offensive rebound, Keita grabbed it, and he kicked to AJ in the corner, and he shot the open three. Like, just do that. I think eventually he'll grow into taking more threes at the next level. But I guess you could say, or maybe some of my cohorts in the draft community, their concerns are his inability to block shots and get steals. We see he's 6'9". He's got the wingspan. He's got the athleticism. He's got the motor. You would think, or you would like to think, that he should be a better person at creating defensive plays, and he just hasn't done that yet. But as I dig into the numbers and I look deeper into it, like Jaylen Brown, who, you know, you're a Celtics fan, is what we call a very good defender at the position. We saw what he did to Luka in the finals a couple years ago. Like, he has a similar block rate, a similar steal rate as AJ DiBonsa in college. So this is going to come down to, will AJ be able to lock in, even though he's not really, you know, blocking shots, creating steals. But he's just such a good playmaker. And again, regardless of the 3-point shots not being attempted as maybe as much as we want them to, like, his ability to adjust at halftime. I believe this is the third time where he just had a monster second half. We saw it against Connecticut. I believe he did against Dayton, or was it Miami, where he just figured it out. And then obviously this game here where he put Clemson away by himself. Like, I like to judge my draft picks, how they handle adversity. And, like, he's getting A's across the board when it comes to adversity.
When you talk about the block and steal rate being so low for AJ DiBonsa, I think a little bit as, like, some awareness. Sometimes I feel like he's a bit lost off ball. Do you think it's anything else? Like what do you put into that? Because I feel like effort isn't a question with him. I feel like there's an intensity that he brings to the floor. Why is that rate so low, in your opinion?
I think it sometimes he can get lost off the ball, but it's definitely not effort, because that same effort that I would like to see him put forward to blocking shots or getting steals, he grabbed two offensive rebounds in the second half to kind of start that run to get them back into the game. And even before that, I want to say in the first half, he poked the ball. He didn't get credit for a steal, but he did force a turnover. It's just a matter of locking in more, doing it more often. And I don't necessarily think that that's going to be something that, like, drops him for his draft range. I mean, he's going to go 1, 2, or 3. We can almost assume that to be guaranteed. I don't necessarily think that's going to deter a team. It's just something that you would want to see more from him, because he has all the physical tools to be a very good help side defender. And I mean, we've talked about it before. Like, I think he's, even though the numbers don't say it right now, he's at his best in transition, but he's going to get transition opportunities if he plays the passing lanes. So like, that's just something that I want to see from him. Maybe it's nitpicking, but again, we're talking about a draft that has potentially three number one picks. So you got to have to dig past the surface with these guys.
One of those other number one picks made his return over the weekend. Darren Peterson returned to Kansas from a hamstring injury. He had 17 points on 6 of 14 against Missouri. What did you see from Peterson in that game, James?
It's good to see him back. I don't know if he's 100%.
And doesn't look like at it. Didn't look like it is full burst. Like,
yeah, and you know what? I look at the numbers and I want to say he only has like 5 rim attempts in the half court. Now, again, it's only been 3 games and I think he still has like 3 dunks still. So, but I don't know if he's not healthy or if he's not 100%. I know it seems like for sure he doesn't trust the burst. And maybe that's why he's settling for some of these threes that he's taking. I have him at a 50% 3-point rate, and coming out of high school, at Prolific Prep, he was at 36%, which means 36% of all his attempts were threes. On Adidas, it was 24%. So for now, half his shots are threes. And I don't know if that's intentional. I know he wanted to add to it, to clean up some of his efficiency, but he's taking a lot of threes. But at the same time, it's hard to argue with the process because he's making them and he's averaging something like a point per minute. And we haven't seen like him put together 2 great halves yet. So it's like he's averaging 20. He had 24, I believe, in the scrimmage against Louisville, and he didn't play the whole second half. Even this game against Missouri, like, they set him down, he was getting treatment. Like, I want to see him play a 38-minute game and see what it looks like, because he's scoring so easily now, and he really hasn't put together a 3-level scoring game yet.
I'm seeing right now on Synergy he has 8 attempts at the rim out of 39 shots so far. 8 out of 39 at the rim. It's pretty low. Obviously, like you said, it's only 3 games, but that is extremely low for Peterson. So, you know, in Kansas's upcoming games, I would assume that is the number one thing you're going to be watching for. They have NC State on Saturday and then a couple of other games on Tuesday, and then the following Monday before Christmas. So only 3 more games ahead of Christmas. So actually, that is a good thing schedule-wise for Peterson and his recovery as well. Can ramp up a little bit before the schedule gets a bit busier in January with only 3 games ahead of Christmas right now. But ultimately, I do think that's a good point with the at-rim rate. It is funny, like with these 3 potential number one picks, Peterson, Boozer at Duke, and then DeBonta at BYU, they're all very different. And yes. I really don't think the number one pick is going to be clear until May with the lottery determining who actually has the number one pick, because it's, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder this year. Someone's number one pick is not going to be another team's number one pick. They'll be their number 3 or maybe their 4, but likely just the number 3. We'll see with Boozer. But one of the guys that I think people, you know, thought has a chance to break through was Nate Amendt at Tennessee. And that hasn't happened for him so far this season, James. Discuss what the appeal was in Nate Amendt and what's behind his struggle so far this season.
So going into this draft, I want to say I had Nate Amendt at probably 6 or 7. He struggled at the rim on the Adidas shoe circuit, but he did shoot the ball pretty well. He's a late bloomer. I know 24/7 ranked him as their number one prospect, and I don't know if. It looks like a mental thing to me, at least today at this point, because he's passing up open jump shots. And for someone who was billed to be a shooter, first possession of the game, the last game against, I believe, Illinois, he passed up a corner 3, drove and kicked it out. He's passing up threes over Feast Week. And then he airballed a 3 long in the corner. And that is alarming to me, because if you're struggling with your confidence in December, November, what does it look like when we get an SEC play? When we know the SEC is going to be extremely tough. Coming out of high school, coming out of the AAU circuit, I wasn't necessarily buying him as a play starter And it looks like that's what Tennessee is trying to use him as. I know they had the Kevin Durant comparisons, and it's not fair to Nate Amen or even any of these kids. There's some coming up in these up and coming draft classes. The tall, skinny kid is not going to be Kevin Durant. I thought Amen was going to be a better shooter than he is right now off the catch. That's the most alarming thing to me. His struggles at the rim, I kind of expected it, even with the added weight. He just doesn't have like a great first step, and his handle is just good. I think he should be an outside in guy, meaning his rim attempts, rim pressure is going to come off of him making shots. But if he's not making shots, then how's he, you know, going to score? I believe it was last four games, and they're playing against like top 100 competition. He's averaging like 12-6. And this one, like 25%, 20% from three splits. And really the saving grace for Nate Amen, and he's been productive, is that he's getting to the foul line at an extremely high rate. But he's not making shots. He just doesn't look confident. And I hope he's able to turn it around. But right now, he just looks like he's out there. And I don't know if it's the draft or whatever it is. He's just not playing like how I thought he could play. Didn't think he was going to be able to crack the top five, but I just didn't see a guy who was not making jump shots.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think with him, you're right. There's a mental component to it for him. But that is, I think, in part related to the physical component with him as well. You mentioned the at-rim struggles that he's had throughout, you know, different levels of basketball. So far this season for Tennessee, he's 11 for 30 at the rim in the half court, according to Synergy. And at times, it just looks like he lacks the quickness to create any space at all, any separation. And then other times, if he is able to create a little sliver of room, he's just unable to break off that with any type of strength. He lacks strength. He lacks quickness. He lacks verticality and really tight spaces with other shot blockers and contesters in the paint. And it's just, it's really affecting him negatively. And if he's not making shots, as you said, well, he's not scoring at the rim. Just drawing fouls and getting at the free throw line. There's no guarantee that that's going to continue manifesting for him once the schedule gets tougher during SEC play. Like you said, they have a lot of tough games coming up, man. I mean, just in the next few weeks, they have Louisville, Arkansas, Florida, Alabama over this next month until mid-late January. So a lot of tough ones on the schedule for Tennessee, and he is not looking like a top five pick potentially so far this year, unfortunately. But other guys, as we've talked about on the pod and we'll talk about in the weeks to come, who knows? We'll see. Who do you have right now, James, last thing, in your four and five spots on your boards, kind of rounding out that top five?
I'm hovering in between Caleb Wilson and Michael Brown Jr. as four and five. Caleb Wilson had some touch issues early on, but he was making everything the last game. But I'm still buying his motor, his athleticism, his defensive chops that he does have. I know Michael Brown Jr. is struggling from the field, but I do think he's the best passer in his draft. And I do think at 6'5", you know, he provides the way that the NBA is trending for the point guard position. They're trying to get bigger. And at 6'5", I think once he figures out when to shoot, when to pass, and what kind of shots are good for me to take, I think he'll end up being like the best point guard from this class. But also you got guys like Kingston Flemings who's just rising to me up the draft boards. He's somebody that I just couldn't deny it anymore. I had to put him in my top 10. Coa Pete, we know, has been very productive. Me and you, we talked about Cameron Carr in the past. So, but I think four and five right now, I guess if you would do a tier system, it's Caleb Wilson and then Michael Brown. And then there's guys who are like on their heels for that fifth spot in the draft, at least in my opinion.
I mean, the Kingston Flemings rise is pretty remarkable. I remember a couple of weeks back, I had Sam Vecenie on the podcast, and we had Kingston Flemings as a weekly mover. And I think at that point, if I remember, I might be paraphrasing incorrectly, but if I remember correctly, Sam had said like he was kind of off his radar as a prospect for this year. And then he had his big performance against Auburn, and it's ever since then it's been big performance after big performance after big performance, including against Tennessee. Even though they lost that game with his 25 point on 10 of 15 games, so continues to rise. The board is ever changing. It's still very, very early in the year as we now enter December. James, I appreciate you joining me today, man. Please let people know where they can find all your stuff.
So I'm on X. I'm at Draft Junkie James. I'm on YouTube, NBA Draft Junkies. And I am on Substack writing articles on NBA at NBABigBoard.com. If you can't remember all that, just find me on X and then you'll see what I talk about there. So I tweet about basketball all the time. I love the game. Good to see some of my favorite players play well. Like, I mean, you know, I'm a huge Derrick Queen fan. I'm watching every Derrick Queen game, man. He makes me look smart.
Been amazing.
I had to put the glasses on. Man. Derrick Queen got me looking like a genius, man. So I thought he
would you
top
have Queen
five
ranked? He was in your top five, right?
I had him at top five, right? Yeah. And I said that, like, the stuff that he had, and this is before the combine where he tanked it, but I was like, I don't care about his combine numbers. Like, put a basketball in his hand and he's going
really
to destroy everybody. Yeah, he tanked the combine. And like, he's a special, special talent. So I had to put the glasses on in honor of Derrick Queen. Got me looking smart. So yeah, for sure. Big fan of the game, but yeah.
I had Tom Haverstraw on the podcast earlier. And he's mentioned like the Pelicans are must-watch basketball. Weird thing to
they
say
are
for a three-win
so
team,
fun.
But they are.
Yeah. And I was like, again, glasses on because you know I'm trying to look smart. But you know I was really high on Jeremiah Fears, and he's like way ahead
Fears
of schedule.
Nice.
He's supposed to be in college right now. He's just turned 19 in like I believe October. So like I know the Pelicans don't have a pick, and that's a whole other story in itself. But I watch every Pelicans game. I put it on an iPad while I'm trying to watch another game. If I don't watch it, I wake up and watch the game in the morning. Like, they're such a fun team, and they're going to be that team that figures it out, I hope, in like 2 to 3 years because they got two really good pieces. Yeah, I hope. But, I mean, regardless, like, Derrick Queen, if you like basketball, tune in to Derrick Queen.
Oh, no. 3-22 on the year, the New Orleans Pelicans without their own pick. And yet they're fun. They are a fun
ton of
team.
Fun. Yeah.
They are fun. It's not about the win or loss. Well, it kind of is, unfortunately, for them with the Hawks having the rights to their pick. But yes, there's still reasons to feel optimism with the New Orleans Pelicans, in part due to Derrick Queen and Jeremiah Fears, like you said. James, appreciate you joining me today, man. This is a lot of fun.
Appreciate you for having me.
Thank you to Tom and James for joining me on today's episode. Thank you to Emmy for producing the show. Thanks to Father John Misty for the music. And if you're still listening, please be sure to check out at Yahoo NBA on YouTube. That's where we're going to be putting all of our NBA podcast content. My show, The Dunker Spot, The Big Number. We're going to be doing breakdown videos on there as well. We got a lot of fun stuff planned. That's launching on December 22nd, but you're able to subscribe now on YouTube ahead of time. That's at Yahoo NBA. Hope you have a good rest of your day. Enjoy the NBA Cup and hope you have a beautiful weekend.